The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine this week, dated October 5th, 2012. We'll begin, as always, from the main story section of The Week magazine. The first article is entitled, "The Fight Over Voter ID, What Happened?" A legal battle over voter identification laws raged this past week in several states as Democrats tried to block a Republican-led effort to require people to show state-issued photo ID at the polls for this election. With November 6th, just weeks away, courts in Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and Wisconsin were weighing challenges to new voter ID laws, which Democrats contend were passed to restrict voting by young people and minorities who are less likely to hold state-issued IDs. State courts have temporarily blocked implementation of the laws in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin until they rule on the challenges, and federal judges this week heard arguments on South Carolina's ID law. At least 10 Republican-governed states, including Florida and Ohio, have introduced voter ID laws since 2010. Democrats argue that voter fraud is almost non-existent in the U.S. The Advancement Project, a civil rights advocacy group, claimed this past week that restrictive new voting policies could prevent 10 million Hispanics from casting ballots this year. But Republicans contend that thousands of dead voters, out-of-state residents, and illegal immigrants can be found on every state's voter rolls, and that even a little fraud could tip close elections. "Implementing common-sense reforms at the ballot box ensures the fairness of our election," said Alexandra Franceschi, a spokesperson for the National Republican Committee. Now here's what the editorials had to say. "The voter suppression campaigns of the Jim Crow South are back in a big way," said the New York Times. "Voter ID laws are one form of that campaign. Another is True the Vote, a Tea Party group that plans to send white poll watchers to black and Hispanic districts in 30 states to aggressively challenge any suspicious voters. There's no moral or legal justification for this harassment," said the Louisville Courier-Journal. The Brennan Center for Justice, in fact, recently concluded after an extensive study that in-person voter fraud simply does not exist. "That's just not true," said NationalReview.com. A Republican city commissioner recently uncovered 23 cases of unregistered voters casting a ballot in Philadelphia, and he examined just 15 of the city's 1,687 election districts. "The integrity of the election process demands better protection." Now here's what the columnist said. "Voter ID laws are no obstacle to voting," said Hans von Spakovsky, also in NationalReview.com. "Every state that has one has also made free IDs available to those who don't have them. And many, including Georgia and Indiana, actually saw turnout go up, not down, after passing them. Little wonder 74% of the public supports voter ID laws," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "Most people can see they're inherently reasonable. Americans need to show picture ID to board an airplane, conduct a bank transaction, even buy a beer. Why shouldn't they need one to vote?" "Buying a beer isn't a constitutionally protected right," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, "and to infringe such rights is a crime against democracy. Minorities, poor people, college students, and seniors are less likely to have driver's licenses than other Americans, often live miles from the nearest DMV or post office, and may lack transportation. Presented with this challenge, many will simply stay home on Election Day, which is exactly why Republicans passed these laws. Consider the data from Philadelphia, said Andrew Rosenthal in NYTimes.com. About 18% of voters in that heavily African-American city have no ID. Undoubtedly, GOP State Representative Mike Terzai had that fact in mind when he predicted in June that the state's ID law would allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Remember the 2000 election, said Stephen Olmacher in the Associated Press. Thanks to voter ID laws, we might be seeing a repeat. ID laws allow voters who show up to the polls without required identification to cast provisional ballots, and in some states, including Florida, there may be hundreds of thousands of such ballots, all of which may be challenged. The challenges can take days or even weeks to resolve. If the results of this presidential election are as close as Bush versus Gore in 2000, provisional ballots could be the next hanging chads. The next article from the main story section of the week is entitled, At the UN, Obama Defends Free Speech. President Obama delivered an impassioned defense of freedom of speech at the United Nations this past week and challenged Arab leaders to denounce the anti-American violence that has flared across the Muslim world. Speaking at the UN General Assembly in New York, Obama condemned the U.S.-made anti-Islam video that ostensibly sparked the recent riots as crude and disgusting. But he explained that the First Amendment protects even hateful writings, film, and speech. As president, I accept that people are going to call me awful things every day, he said, and I will always defend their right to do so. Obama called on Arabs to denounce the slander of the Prophet of Islam, to also speak out against radicals who destroy Christian churches, deny the Holocaust, and use hatred of America or the West or Israel as the central principle of politics. Obama also issued a warning to Iran, saying there was limited time to resolve the standoff over the country's nuclear program through diplomacy. A nuclear-armed Iran cannot be contained, Obama said. The United States will do what we must do to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, but he refused to set the specific red line for military action that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had demanded. In his speech before the UN, Iranian President Mohammad Ahmadinejad, scoffed at Obama's warning, told the UN meeting that his country was being threatened by uncivilized Zionists, and likened Israel to the devil. Now here's what the editorial said. Obama has sent a vital message to the Middle East, said the Washington Post. Many people there automatically blame the U.S. government for the anti-Muslim video, a vile but obscure piece of internet flotsam, because their own authoritarian rulers control every media outlet. By explaining that the U.S. government does not sponsor or endorse religious slander, but defends all free speech, Obama has addressed a deadly misunderstanding. His warning to Iran was nothing more than rhetoric, said the Wall Street Journal. Obama promised that he would prevent the Islamic Republic from going nuclear, but the cold reality is that after nearly 4 years of failed diplomacy and half-hearted sanctions, neither Iran nor Israel believe him. Indeed, Ahmadinejad was jaunty and arrogant during his visit to New York, snidely flashing peace signs and describing Israel as a short-lived historical aberration that would soon be eliminated. Now here's what the columnist said. This was the president at his best, said John Avlon in the DailyBeast.com. He robustly defended America's support for the Arab Spring uprisings in almost Bushian tones, declaring that freedom and self-determination are not simply American values or Western values. They are universal values. At a time when the rift between the U.S. and the Muslim world is growing, this was the speech Obama needed to give and the world needed to hear. The words were pretty but cowardly, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Obama has never voiced a word of objection when evangelical Christians are vilified, when art displays portray Jesus in offensive ways, or when Broadway musicals jab at Mormons. But he's quick to denounce an obscure YouTube video as slander to appease Muslim extremists. The president should have told the UN that the U.S. does not label obnoxious speech slander nor apologize for it. It defends liberty, period. By calling on Arab leaders to denounce all hate speech, said Brett Schaefer in NationalReview.com, Obama actually lent credibility to the notion that governments should be policing speech. In discussing Iran, Obama had a good reason to be vague about what might trigger a military response, said Tony Karen in Time.com. U.S. allies in Europe support sanctions primarily because they believe they are the only alternative to Israel starting a potentially disastrous war. If the U.S. ever decides to attack Iran over its nuclear program, it will likely do so with an even smaller coalition of the willing than President Bush had when he invaded Iraq. For now, Obama is holding out for a diplomatic solution. But if he gets a second term, he won't be able to kick this can down the road much longer, and he'll be held responsible for the outcome. Now, from this week's edition of The Week magazine, let's turn to the controversy of the week. It's entitled Romney, What He Must Do to Close the Gap. Mitt Romney is running for president as the ultimate turnaround expert, a guy who can walk in, figure out what's wrong, and fix it, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. The Republican may still get a chance to fix the struggling U.S. economy, but first he must show he can do it with his campaign. As the race for the White House enters its final month, Romney's campaign is bleeding, hurt by a lack of a clear, compelling message and by a string of self-inflicted wounds, including the videotape showing him writing off 47% of Americans. He's trailing President Obama by nearly 4 points in an average of national polls and by alarmingly wide margins in battleground states such as Ohio, Virginia, Wisconsin, and even must-win Florida. For Mitt, the real danger now is the gathering narrative that he's already lost the race, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. The nightmare scenario is that the Republican National Committee and pro-GOP super PACs decide to give up on him and focus their money and resources on House and Senate races so as to blunt the impact of a second Obama term. If things don't start looking better for Mitt Romney soon, in other words, they're going to get a lot worse for him and very quickly. Romney's last best shot at saving his campaign is next week's debate. That is the debate that will have occurred by the time you hear this. And the two that follow, said Jules Witkover in the Baltimore Sun. Those are his big chances to stop playing defense, go on offense, and convince undecided voters that he really is a better bet than Obama for getting the economy going again. If this performance on 60 Minutes this past week is any indication, said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com, Romney just might pull that off. The usually stiff and cautious Romney was a vision of unblinking confidence, and his responses to tough questions sounded both sincere and reasonable. If this is the candidate who shows up to debate Obama on Wednesday, we could just a week away from stories declaring a reset for Romney. We could be there. He'll need more than a confident manner, said the Financial Times in an editorial. Romney has to make voters believe he really is Mr. Fix-It and tell a credible story about how he would lead the U.S. into a strong recovery. Up to now, Romney has been maddeningly vague about his economic and tax proposals. His only hope is to work out what he wants to say on the economy and then keep saying it. It's still a winnable race for Romney, said Ramesh Punuru in NationalReview.com. But what's really hurting him is the perception that he's an out-of-touch plutocrat whose policies would help the rich but do nothing for the struggling middle class. In the debates and on the campaign trail, Romney needs to emphasize again and again how his agenda would help the vast majority of Americans. "Mark my words, this race will tighten up very soon," said Robert Wright in TheAtlantic.com. In the debates, Romney has a good chance of outshining Obama, who is not a deft, off-the-cuff speaker and has proved in the past to be a wordy, mediocre debater. And believe it or not, the media will soon help Romney get back in the race. If there's one thing the media won't tolerate for long, it's an unchanging media narrative. Today's story that Romney is in big trouble will yield to a fresh story. Romney's coming back. Stay tuned, America. We've got ourselves a close election after all. Now, from the Week magazine, we will turn to the very popular section called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for the NFL Referees Union after a replacement ref who'd been working high school games blew a call at the end of a nationally televised game, robbing the Green Bay Packers of a victory and causing a national furor. The NFL, with revenues of $10 billion, locked out its refs in a dispute over $3 million in pension costs. It was a good week for investing in a phone case after a study by warranty service provider Square Trade found that iPhone customers have spent $5.9 billion for repairs since the original iPhone was introduced in 2007. And it was a good week for truth in advertising after a New Jersey homeowner put up a sign on the lawn reading, "House for sale by owner," because my neighbor is an a-hole. You can fill in the blanks there. Unusual approach. And it was a bad week for climate change after Britain's National Pig Association warned that due to withering droughts and soaring grain prices, a world shortage of pork and bacon next year is now unavoidable. It was a bad week for forgetting to check your privacy settings after 3,000 people showed up to a birthday party in the Netherlands when a 16-year-old girl forgot to check private on a Facebook invitation. The partygoers vandalized local shops, set a car on fire, and threw rocks and bottles at 600 police officers sent to control the crowd. And it was a bad week for not knowing how to drive a stick after Anthony Reynolds, 18 years old, of Newark, New Jersey, pleaded guilty to carjacking a Porsche 911 Turbo. After Reynolds ordered the car's owner to get out, he herked and jerked while trying to operate the superfast car's manual transmission and stalled out. Police then grabbed him. You're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll now turn to the briefing section of the week, and this week the title is Downsizing the Military. The looming defense sequester would slash the Pentagon's budget by $55 billion a year. Would that imperil the nation? Why is the military facing cuts? It's the result of Congress's inability to reach any compromise on how to cut the deficit-ridden federal budget. In August 2011, congressional Republicans and the White House agreed to extend the nation's debt ceiling on the condition that a bipartisan supercommittee would find ways to reduce the deficit by $1.5 trillion over 10 years through spending cuts, revenue increases, or some combination of the two. Attempts to reach a grand bargain collapsed last November, triggering a sequester, a set of automatic cuts painful to both parties that had been inserted in the debt ceiling legislation in an attempt to force a compromise. The automatic cuts would chop the Pentagon's budget by about $500 billion over 9 years, starting on January 2, 2013, and cut another $500 billion from non-defense programs. Now that that date is looming, many Republicans want to cancel the sequester through legislation, warning that the mandated cuts pose a serious threat to our national security. Can the Pentagon absorb these cuts? Not according to the Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, who has said they will turn the military into a paper tiger. The sequester would shave $55 billion a year from the Pentagon's spending, roughly 10% of its budget. To meet that target, the House Armed Services Committee has said the Army would have to fall from 569,000 active duty soldiers today to 426,000, the lowest number since World War II. The Air Force would go from having 1,990 fighter aircraft to 1,512, and the Navy would see a reduction from 286 ships to 230. Spending on training would have to be slashed across all services, as would investment in repairs and new equipment. The U.S. would be left with a force that suffers low morale, poor readiness, and is unable to keep up with potential adversaries, said Panetta. In effect, it invites aggression. Critics, however, have accused the Pentagon of wildly exaggerating the cut's impact. How so? Well, after sequestration, the core defense budget, which doesn't include the cost of the war in Afghanistan, will stand at $472 billion in 2013. That's roughly the same level of spending as in 2007, the next-to-last year of the Bush administration. Not even defense hawks were complaining about the budget being too low in 2007, says Lawrence Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. At $472 billion, the U.S. will still be spending more on its military than the next 17 nations combined, and three times more than China. Democrats contend that with the war in Iraq over and U.S. involvement in Afghanistan winding down, the Pentagon can afford to let go of the 84,000 military personnel it added after 9/11. The Defense Department could also scrap or reduce orders for questionable weapon systems like the F-35 strike fighter, which will cost more than $200 million per plane, despite what the Government Accountability Office has described as mixed performance. But if the Pentagon suddenly slashed orders for new equipment, defense firms argue that they'd have no choice but to lay off workers. How many jobs would be lost? The Aerospace Industries Association says that the defense sequester would cost more than 1 million jobs by the end of 2013. The impact on industry would be devastating, said Robert Stevens, CEO of defense giant Lockheed Martin. He told Congress that his company, which received 82% of its revenues from the government in 2011, might be forced to furlough 10,000 of its 120,000 employees if the cuts go ahead. But Todd Harrison, a senior fellow at the Independent Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, disputes that figure, saying that the industry wouldn't feel the impact of sequestration for 3 to 4 years because of weapons programs already in the pipeline. This gives industry more time to adjust employment levels through natural attrition or early retirements, he said. Can the sequester be avoided? No agreement is likely before the election, even afterward a lame duck Congress and President Obama, who will remain in office until January 20th, regardless of the outcome on Election Day, might find it impossible to reach a compromise by January 1. Republicans are still arguing that the military should be exempt from any spending cuts, and the budget plan presented by GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney would raise defense spending by up to $150 billion a year. That's a non-starter for Democrats. The Republican chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Buck McKeon, is now trying to persuade Democrats and Republicans to work together on legislation that will postpone sequestration in the hope of getting a broader budget fix later. That grand bargain will have to include serious defense cuts, said Republican Senator Tom Coburn, if America has any hope of reducing its $16 trillion debt. Will people squeal? Yes, he said. Everybody is going to have to squeal if we are to get out of the problem we have in this country. And our footnote to the Downsizing the Military briefing for this week is entitled, The Army's Unwanted Tanks. Last year, the U.S. Army made an unusual request to Congress, stop sending us tanks. That plea was issued after legislators ignored the Army's objections and approved a defense appropriations bill that included $255 million for 42 new M1 Abrams tanks. With 2,300 M1s already deployed around the world and 3,000 more sitting idle at a base in California's Sierra Nevada mountains, the military said it simply didn't need any more tanks. But Ohio politicians pushed for the extra M1s so as to keep open an 800-worker tank plant in the state. A lot of lawmakers stuff funding into defense bills that could benefit their district, said Steve Ellis, vice president of taxpayers for Common Sense. Republican Representative Jim Jordan, whose district is home to the tank plant, insisted that he supported the program for reasons of national security. I think it's in the best interest of the U.S. to defend our country, he said. Now let's take a look at the best columns in the U.S. this past week, at least according to The Week magazine. Our first column is entitled, Why the U.S. Has Such Huge Deficits, by Ross Dutat in the New York Times. Washington, D.C. is booming, which is a very bad sign for the rest of America, said Ross Dutat. A new Census Bureau report has found that 7 of the 10 richest counties in America are in the Washington, D.C. suburbs in Maryland and in Virginia. As a resident of the area, I've witnessed the rising affluence, new bars and restaurants and high-rises opening up everywhere, and million-dollar real estate listings even in the district itself, where housing was once cheap. Whence comes this wealth? It's not from federal workers themselves, but from the growing armies of lobbyists and lawyers, contractors and consultants who are paid to influence what government does. This legal corruption is a bipartisan affair, driven by both Republicans' fierce protection of the defense establishment and corporate tax goodies, and Democrats slicing up billions of dollars into inefficient health, energy, and safety net programs. The U.S. isn't running $1 trillion deficits because the lower 47% aren't paying enough taxes. We're running those deficits because too many powerful interest groups have a stake in making sure the party doesn't stop. The next column is entitled, Romney was half right on the Mideast, and it's by Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. Mitt Romney has given up on the Middle East peace process, said Jeffrey Goldberg in his now infamous 47% speech at a recent Florida fundraiser. The Republican presidential candidate was recorded flatly dismissing any chance of a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. The Palestinians have no interest whatsoever in establishing peace, Romney said, echoing the hard line of Israel's right wing. This is half true. In the past, the Palestinians have indeed spurned several Israeli attempts to compromise over disputed territories, and today the Palestinians are so divided between radical and moderate factions that they probably couldn't make a deal. But in placing blame solely on the Palestinians, Romney neglected to mention that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made negotiation impossible. He's deliberately allowed additional settlements in disputed East Jerusalem and the West Bank, knowing that no Palestinian leader will accept this humiliating loss of territory. So Romney isn't wrong to say the Palestinians seem uninterested in peace. He just neglected to mention that the other player in this conflict isn't particularly interested either. And the third column from this week's Best Columns in the U.S., it's entitled, Were Our Ancestors Stupid? And it's by James Flynn in the Wall Street Journal. Are people really getting smarter? Asked James Flynn. That's what IQ tests would suggest. Over the past century, Americans have gained 3 to 5 IQ points per decade on average. This would seem to suggest that our forefathers were dumb and that the human brain itself has gotten larger. Not so. The real explanation is that IQ tests measure intelligence of a certain sort, the abstract reasoning, pattern making, and symbolism you find in modern societies. A century ago, people thought in concrete, pragmatic terms. Asked what a rabbit and a dog had in common, they might answer, "You use a dog to hunt rabbits." Well, today, the correct answer is they're both mammals. Is the latter response more intelligent than the former? Not really. In our grandparents' or great-grandparents' time, most people had little education and had to focus mostly on survival. Knowing how to hunt rabbits was more important than how to classify them. Today, education, technology, and a constant bath of information have changed how we think and see the world. Our IQs are unquestionably higher, but we are not inherently smarter than our ancestors were. You're listening to our reading of The Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. We're going to turn to the health and science section right now. Our first article is entitled, How Teens' Texts Lead to Unsafe Sex. Teenagers who engage in sexting, sending sexually explicit texts, are far more likely to begin having intercourse at an early age and engage in other risky behavior, a new study has found. The study of 1,800 Los Angeles high school students shows that 1 in 7 has sent a sext message and that those who have are 7 times more likely to be sexually active. Teens who sext, especially girls, are also more likely to have unprotected sex, sleep with multiple partners, and use drugs or alcohol before having intercourse. What we really wanted to know is there a link between sexting and taking risks with your body? And the answer is a pretty resounding yes. Study author Eric Rice, who is a researcher at the University of Southern California, tells Reuters.com. The fact that some teen girls have suffered humiliation when ex-boyfriends widely distributed photos of them naked doesn't seem to be registering. There is an emerging sense of normalcy around sexting behavior, Rice says. Some 54% of teens say they have a friend who sexts, which makes them 17 times more likely to try it themselves. If their friends do it, Rice says, they're going to do it as well. The next column from the Health and Science section is, What Wedding Jitters Portend? Brides-to-be who feel gnawing doubts about getting married should probably cancel the ceremony. A new study that followed 232 couples for 4 years after their weddings found that brides who admitted worrying that they were making a mistake had a high divorce rate of 19% in that short time, compared with just 8% for those who didn't. Cold feet were more commonplace for men and less predictive of future divorce. About 40% of women reported nagging doubts before their weddings. People think everybody has premarital doubts and you don't have to worry about them, study author Justin Lavner tells LiveScience.com. But such worries are not benign, he says. If you have cold feet but think your doubts will go away when you have a mortgage and 2 kids, study co-author Thomas Bradbury says, don't count on that. The next article from the Health and Science section is Health Scare of the Week, Pain Relievers Damage Hearing. Popping common over-the-counter pain relievers like Tylenol and Advil may take a serious toll on your hearing, says FoxNews.com. Researchers at Harvard's Brigham and Women's Hospital asked more than 62,000 female volunteers to record their use of pain relievers containing acetaminophen and ibuprofen for almost 15 years. They found that the more of the drugs the women took, the more likely they were to report hearing loss. Those who took a pill two or three times a week were about 12% more likely to report hearing loss than those who took less. Upping their use to no more than four times per week increased the risk to more than 20%. Even though these pain relievers are widely available, they're still medications with side effects, says study author Sharon Curhan. Previous studies have linked ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and aspirin to hearing loss in men, though aspirin didn't seem to have any effect on the women in the new study. Though researchers can't prove causation so far, they say it's possible the medications damage hearing by decreasing blood flow to the inner ear. Now we will flip to the back of the Week magazine this week for a look at the article entitled The Last Word. And the specific subject for this week is of vice and men. Garrison Keillor quit smoking and then drinking. What he misses most are the friends who kept indulging. I came along toward the tail end of a grand old tradition of manly self-destructiveness in American writing. Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Faulkner, O'Neill, Chevener, Carver, Tennessee Williams, and then, of course, there was Dylan Thomas, the Welshman. So when I determined at the age of 18 to become a writer, I accepted my obligation to smoke many packs of cigarettes a day and learn how to drink gin and whiskey in goodly amounts, and to shun exercise done for the sake of exercise, no running. Writers were not runners. It was too awkward to run and smoke at the same time. We sat brooding and lit up and refilled the glass. I was a healthy young man who enjoyed tennis and softball and basketball, but I made the leap from beer to bourbon, skipped the low-tar smokes in favor of Lucky's, Camels, Pall Mall's, and, when feeling flush, Gallus's. I drank a gallon of coffee a day, all because that's what writers did. When I was 24, I visited New York City, angling for a writing job, and went to the San Remo, where the poets hung out, and the Cedar Tavern, where the painters were. I studied how they sat, how they held the glass and exhaled the smoke cloud. I perched in the lobby of the Algonquin for 3 hours with the gin and tonic, imagining that E.B. White would walk in and I'd buy him a drink and we'd become pals, which sometimes happens when two guys drink together. My heroes in The New Yorker were unabashed alcoholics. The people in their stories were always sitting down for drinks, and cigarettes were more common than semicolons. If my writing was not yet on a par with Benchley's or Thurber's, I still felt I was on track, style-wise. I was an English major at the University of Minnesota, and I was a very shy guy, which many people misinterpreted as intelligence. On the basis of that wrong impression, I became the editor of the campus literary magazine. I hiked around campus in jeans, white shirt, corduroy jacket, red wing work boots, and a broad-brimmed hat with a pack of smokes in my pocket. If you hadn't anything to say but wanted to appear thoughtful, you reached for the pack and shook a cigarette out. The ceremony of lighting up said more than words. It was thought in motion. Back then, a pack cost 35 cents and a drink was a dollar. John Berryman, James Wright, and Alan Tate were on the faculty. Mr. Tate was 68 when I took his graduate poetry seminar. He was a slim, elegant man with a southern patrician accent, author of Ode to the Confederate Dead, a pal of Robert Penn Warren and Hart Crane. He chain-smoked in class, so we did too. The whole English department reeked of smoke and was proudly alcoholic. Anyone who didn't do both was considered an interloper, possibly a Mormon. In Mr. Wright's humanities class, he stood at a lectern with an empty tuna fish can for an ashtray and chain-smoked through his lectures on Dickens and Whitman and Dickinson, which he delivered through a haze of hangover. He always looked pale and haggard. The line, "Suddenly I realized that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom," was written by a man who felt most at ease with a drink in his hand and smoke coming out of his mouth. As for Mr. Berryman, his readings of the Dream Songs were famous for their high drama, the slurred speech, the poet slumped on the lectern, the sudden lurches into reminiscence, the muttered asides to friends in the audience, the poet almost on the verge of collapse. I sat in the front row, off to the side, and watched the great man. To me, his greatness and his drunkenness seemed intertwined. A true artist must engage with dark forces, and this man was engaging them in his own body in full public view. Fate had driven him to this drunken state, just as it had driven him to create timeless verse, and he could no more give up whiskey than he could stifle his muse. After the reading, I hiked over to the Mixer's Bar in Seven Corners, as I did several nights a week, where English grad students and instructors hung out. I ordered a scotch and soda and tapped my Pall Mall on a fingernail and lit it. Then I slid into a booth with Roland and Arnie and Rob and worked on developing my writerly persona, which, if not as dark as Berryman's, blighted at the age of 12 by his father's suicide by gunshot outside the boy's bedroom window, was nonetheless as dark as I could make it. I had no sorrows beyond what any normal 25-year-old Minnesotan would go through: scarce money, absurd self-consciousness, cold weather, and so I needed the bitter cigarette and the sting of alcohol to create a little drama for myself. In the movies, a man lights a cigarette before he goes off to face death, and after he has faced it, he pours himself a drink. It was dramatic, sitting in the booth, going through a whole pack of smokes, and when someone said, "Another?" and pointed to my glass, I, of course, said, "Yes." That was what writers did. I had a few years before been a YMCA camp counselor. I was not one anymore. I had decamped and moved on. I think of them now, Wright dead at 52, Berryman at 57, Tate lingering on to 79, as the elders of an extinct tribe. Nobody smokes at English department parties anymore, and hard liquor is nowhere to be seen, only wine. A writer wouldn't hesitate to spend the evening nursing a glass of club soda, wouldn't worry that it marked him as a freak. I quit smoking in 1982. 4 packs of Pall Malls a day was my quota. Then shazam, nothing. And went off alcohol in 2005. Both times I worried that I had cursed myself and would never write again and would need to find another career, perhaps as an inspirational speaker. But life went on much as before, except that mornings were brighter and I got to stop worrying about whether I should quit or not. That is enough reason to quit, to take the issue off the table. I, who once created billows of tobacco smoke, now find it irritating. The other night I absent-mindedly sipped from my wife's glass of Pinot Grigio and shuddered at the taste, like battery acid. And now I trot off to the Mayo Clinic down U.S. Highway 52 from where I live in St. Paul, and they run me through rigorous tests. I seem at age 69, knock on wood, bonk, 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 not to have paid a price for those years of disillusion. An MRI here, a CTAN scan there, an echocardiogram, an internist listening with a stethoscope. From all reports, my heart is thumping away like a teenager's. The arteries are clear. Blood pressure is excellent. No spots darken the lungs. Meanwhile, old friends who were athletes in high school and who worked hard to keep fit and eschewed smoking and drinking are complaining of serious stuff. These are skinny men who for 40 years have been putting on sweatpants and T-shirts and jogging a few miles. They are now staring at imminent hip replacements and unaccountably suffering from bad cholesterol and high blood pressure. Glum talk at a party, 69-year-old men, lifelong runners and mountain climbers, now contemplating an operating table, and an orthopedic surgeon whacking at them with a hammer and chisel. And then the OxyContin and long weeks of rehab. After look at me, a man whose main exercise is walking swiftly through airport concourses and whose joints work smoothly and who have thrived on a diet heavy in animal fats. The indolent prosper while the industrious exercisers endure blood full of triglycerides and 80% arterial blockage. Ah, the utter unfairness of life. I inherited pretty good genes. My mother is still motoring around at age 96. My dad lived to be 88. And then, too, I had the wherewithal to quit poisoning myself before I fell over. My friend, the poet Bill Holm, fell down and died at the age of 65. He was a man who maintained his regimen of whiskey and Marlboros even after his heart surgery, and who scorned moderation as the strategy of fear. Though all of us were stunned by his death, nobody was terribly surprised. What killed him was that romance of the artist dancing with death, living headlong, hurtling into the dark, a cigarette in one hand and a drink in the other, a pork roast in the oven, a massive slab of pie on the counter. He never counted calories, never took sparkling water if beer was available. Bill was the last of the tribe whom I knew personally. All my other writer pals are health conscious, watch their weight, exercise, pursue moderation. Bill was determined to be iconic, a Dionysian bull, a two-fisted, foot-on-the-gas-pedal lover of life. I sat in the basement of a Lutheran church and listened to his funeral service, which was going on upstairs. It was a fine service, and we all walked out into the sunny March day in 2009, missing that gentle 6-foot-6-inch bear with the beard and mop of white hair, the red face. I wished Bill could have turned away from his resolute path to the cliff. Old age would have been a blessing for him. He had much more to write about Iceland and American politics and life on the prairie. He had come to despise teaching, which he did for most of his life, and he was overjoyed to retire. Then to fall down in the Sioux Falls airport a year after retirement, having spent most of the winter in Arizona, was a cruel, cruel end. But I understood what drove him, and if I had been told at Mayo that I had 6 months to a year left on Earth, I might have returned to the tribe to relive my 20s. Why not? I'd walk away from abstinence, trot down to the liquor store, pick up a carton of Lucky's, if they still make them, and a pint of Johnny Walker, and go home to relearn the finger ballet of the cigarette and wean myself back on to alcohol. Fill up the room with smoke and feel the warm, sloshy pleasures of inebriation. An eye opener in the morning, a martini for lunch, or two, who's counting, and at 5 p.m. sharp, the sun is over the yardarm and the bar is open, so belly up, gentlemen, and choose your poison. You're the doctor. It's very man for himself. It's every man for himself. Mud in your eye. And here's looking at you, sweetheart. I might grow back my old beard and put on a Panama hat and write heroically again. And that was written by Garrison Keillor. Although I don't sound like him and can't read like him, I can almost hear his voice when I read his words here. It was reprinted by permission of Rodale, Inc. You can hear Garrison Keillor perform his story by downloading the iPad edition of Men's Health September issue on the iTunes newsstand. Now we'll turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine for this week, October 5th, 2012. Our first article here is entitled, Jesus' Wife, Credible Evidence? It's a discovery that may just rock the foundations of Christianity as we know it, said Mary Sherratt in the Wall Street Journal. A 4th-century scrap of papyrus revealed to the world last week states that Jesus Christ had a wife. To be precise, the torn papyrus contains 2 sentence fragments. Jesus said to them, "My wife, and she will be able to be my disciple." The Harvard Divinity professor who unveiled the papyrus, Karen L. King, concedes it doesn't prove that Jesus was married, but it says it does show that some early Christians once believed he was. That would directly contradict the Catholic Church's teaching that Jesus was celibate and had only male apostles. Other recently discovered Christian texts from this era also describe Mary Magdalene as Jesus' wife and companion, said the Reverend Cynthia Borgo in WashingtonPost.com. It was only centuries later that the Church's patriarchal and misogynist hierarchy began equating divine perfection with celibacy, so as to justify keeping women in subordinate positions. "Someone's been reading too much Dan Brown," said Ross Dutat in NYTimes.com. "The clearest explanation for why we don't have any direct evidence of a Mrs. Jesus is that there wasn't one. The most persuasive contemporary account of Jesus' life is the New Testament, which makes no mention of a wife. And a scrap of paper written 400 years after Jesus' crucifixion is hardly evidence of a historical rewrite job by the Church Fathers to suppress women. It's also unlikely to change anything in the Catholic Church," said the Reverend Jonathan Morris in FoxNews.com. "The tradition of the celibate, male-only priesthood is rooted in a determination to imitate Jesus' will as we see it in the Gospel, not as we see it on a fragment of papyrus the size of a business card." "The truth is that we know little about the historical Jesus," said Stephen Prothero in CNN.com. "We don't know if he really had blue eyes and long hair or what he did between childhood and his 30s. This ancient text has caused such a sensation only because of our modern fixation on gender issues and bedroom questions. But in the Gospels, these were the least of Jesus' concerns. His core teaching was one of compassion, that we have a moral obligation to the poor, the sick, and the unloved. Was he married? We'll never know for sure. What matters is his message." The next article from Talking Points, the election, why the polls vary. The Pew Research Center poll shows President Obama opening up an 8-point lead over Mitt Romney. The Gallup poll shows the race dead even, while other polls find small Obama leads. "What's a poor voter supposed to believe?" said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. "With just 5 weeks left before Election Day, respected polls are showing results that are all over the map. That's because political forecasting, like astrology and reading entrails, is a junk science," said Matthew Cananetti, and FreeBeacon.com. "All we can say for sure at this stage is that the race for the White House is still a jump ball, with the RealClearPolitics.com average of polls showing Obama with about a 3-point lead. That could easily melt away after the 3 upcoming debates or because of some big news event or Obama gaffe." "That's conservative wishful thinking," said Will Oramus in Slate.com. "The polls that consistently find Romney doing several points better than the others tend to rely on automated robopolls to conduct their surveys. The law prohibits automated calling to cell phones, and so those polling firms are failing to reach the estimated 1 in 3 U.S. households that has no landline, including many young voters and minorities who tend to vote Democratic. Polls that do include cell phone users show Obama well in front of Romney with a 4.1% lead nationally. Maybe so," said Jay Cost in the New York Post, "but other polls have built-in biases too, including how the pollsters screen for likely voters and what proportion of Democrats and Republicans they include. The critical margin in this election will come from voters who are still undecided, and when the polls are bounced around a lot, no one can really know for sure who will win." Still, the picture's getting clearer, said Nate Silver and NYTimes.com. Obama has held a small but clear lead for weeks now, and with voters becoming more stridently partisan in recent years, they're less likely to change their minds in the final weeks of a campaign. Obama's current lead over Romney of 3 to 4 points is not that impressive for an elected incumbent, but since 1936, fully 18 of 19 candidates who have been ahead in the polls this late in the game have gone on to win the White House. A big swing toward Romney is still possible, but all the data give Obama about an 80% chance of victory. Now let's take a look at a few shorter items from the talking points section here as we wrap up the program for this week. More Americans now take their own lives each year, about 37,000, than die in car crashes. A new study has found while safety improvements have cut the death toll of car crashes by 25%, suicides have kept rising, at least partly because of the country's economic problems, foreclosures, and joblessness. Thanks in part to the pinging and ringing of our digital devices, roughly 41 million people in the U.S., nearly a third of all working adults, get 6 hours or less of sleep a night, according to a new study, and that was reported in the New York Times. I Love Lucy made its last episode in 1957, but the show still earns CBS $20 million a year through syndication fees. Lucy lives on. The huge internet data centers that store and process everything from old emails to Facebook data and Google searches use about 30 billion watts of electricity worldwide, equivalent to the output of 30 nuclear power plants. Only about 10% of that energy powers actual computations. The rest keeps servers running around the clock so as to avoid any slowdowns that would annoy users. And now let's take a look at the poll watch for this week. A record 60% of Americans say they have little or no confidence in mass media to report the news fairly or accurately, an increase of 5% since just last year. 40% have a great deal or fair amount of trust in the media. Republicans, 26%, and independents, 31%, are less likely than Democrats, 58%, to trust the media. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.